On this week's edition of New York Now, access to justice. How has COVID-19 affected the state's justice system and those who use it? First, crime is down statewide, but what does that mean? Members of law enforcement say it's more than just people staying home. Then, COVID-19 could cause a flood of legal disputes. State Bar Association President Hank Greenberg says they're offering help. We'll have details. Plus, it could be harder for you to win a COVID-19 related lawsuit down the road. Tom Stebbins from the Lawsuit Reform Alliance explains why. And John Campbell from the USA Today Network is here with the news of the week. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority will pass legislation
law prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. On this week's show, we're talking all about the access to justice and how that's changed during the COVID-19 crisis. And we actually had some news on that this week that's tied into the economy. Let's get into it with John Campbell from the USA Today Network. John, thanks so much for joining us here on New York Now this week.
Hey, Dan, thank you for having me.
Anytime. So we had some major news this week, and it's tied into the courts, but more importantly for a lot of our viewers watching, it's tied into the economy. We now have at least 5 regional economies that are going to be able to start the first phase of reopening this weekend. John, what does that mean for these economies? We're in phase 1 for them right now. So what does it look like going into this weekend for them?
Yeah, so what it means is, for a big swath of upstate New York, they're going to be able to begin the reopening process. And that, it sounds as though, like, perhaps, you know, you can just open your doors and be ready to go there. But it's more complicated than that. This is phase 1, which means that construction businesses, manufacturing businesses, supply chain businesses, and retail stores can resume in-person operations. Retail stores, however, will only be able to allow curbside pickup. And under the state's program, under Governor Cuomo's plan here, that phase will stay in place for at least 2 weeks as the state continues to monitor the COVID-19 rate in those particular regions. It's possible they could slow that down, speed that up going forward. But for 2 weeks, that's what's going to be open in those regions before you start to expand to in-person retail operations and more businesses in phase 2, 3, and 4.
So the reason why this ties into this week's show with the access to justice is because in those 5 regions that are reopening, the state court system announced on Wednesday that courts would kind of transition into their own first phase of restarting court operations. I think judges and some court staff would be allowed in. And just to list those 5 regions for our viewers, it's the Southern Tier, Central New York, Mohawk Valley, Finger Lakes, and the North Country. John, when we're looking at the state's courts, just because that's what we're talking about on this week's show, do we know what kind of precautions they're going to be taking going forward to keep everybody safe that would be coming into the actual courthouse?
Well, absolutely. And courthouses across the state, it's going to be in about 30 counties of the state's 62 counties. They're going to be able to reopen to in-person operations. But it's not going to just be business as usual. You're going to see social distancing. Just like in these businesses that are reopening, you're going to have to see that at courthouses as well. The court system also made very clear that you can file cases electronically. They very obviously want you to do that because it cuts down on the number of people that are in these courthouses. But it's a big step. You know, these courthouses, court operations never totally shut down, but they were very limited to in-person operations. There were more virtual court proceedings. Now you're going to be able to see more of the in-person. The judges are going to be able to go back to their chambers. A limited number of support staff are also going to be able to go back. And that's the change you're going to see, but only in those regions that have the green light to begin the reopening process.
So, John, we have 5 regions that are ready to reopen. We have 5 that are not ready to reopen. Do we know what the hang-up is in those regions generally? I know that they're all different, but is it a matter of hospitalizations? Is it a matter of testing? Do we see a pattern here, or is it kind of all over the place?
If you look at a region like the Capital Region, they were very, very close to reopening. They had met 6 of the 7 criteria, but then they had a major setback yesterday, Thursday, when the state's data came out, and their hospitalizations had increased just a little bit. But it was enough to derail 14 straight days of decline on a three-day rolling average in hospitalizations, and it sent him back to square one. That means theoretically they're at least 14 days from starting the reopening process. In other areas, you know, central New York, they were very close on testing capacity. They finally got up over the hump on Friday, and they did get the green light to reopen.
All right, well, we will leave it there. John Campbell from the USA Today Network, thanks for being here on New York Now to start the show this week.
Thank you for having me.
Crime in New York looks very different right now than it did last year. And COVID-19 is a big part of that, but not the only reason. I spoke with members of law enforcement from around the state to learn more. Crime was down by double digits in every county of the state in March and the first half of April. That's according to data obtained by New York Now from the State Division of Criminal Justice Services. And the answer as to why seems obvious. With COVID-19 going on, everybody's staying home, so there are just fewer opportunities for crime to happen. But I wanted to know if there was something else that we're not looking at, if there were other factors that we're not realizing that just aren't down on paper. So I called up three prosecutors, Albany County DA David Soares, Orange County DA David Hoover, and Erie County DA John Flynn. All three said that yes, more people are staying home, but there's more to the data than just self-isolation. In Albany County, arrests in March and the first half of April were about a third of what they were last year. Misdemeanor arrests dropped more than felonies. Soares said it's possible that minor offenses are a lower priority for members of law enforcement right now, meaning they might let some of those crimes go in the interest of public safety.
Law enforcement, in an effort to flatten the curve, is certainly using greater restraints in terms of what they exercise discretion, you know, over and what they don't. So I don't think we're seeing a lot of the petty offenses, quality of life offenses being charged right now because people are really prioritizing the threats to public safety.
Down in Orange County, Hoover said members of law enforcement may also be spread more thin than usual, not only because of COVID-19, but because of a series of criminal justice reforms that took effect this year. Hoover doubles as the president of the DA's Association. He said the new criminal justice laws have given law enforcement more to do, but not more time to do it.
I think, number one, the criminal justice reforms passed in January caused a slight dip. I think that as a result of those reforms and the added workload, a lot of prosecutors decided that certain crimes, they weren't going to necessarily prosecute as much as they did in the past.
Both Soares and Hoover also noted that the new criminal justice laws have changed the way the state measures the number of arrests. Because of those laws, lower-level charges are often given desk appearance tickets instead of being arrested. That means they wouldn't be counted in the number of arrests.
It's going to be very different the way that we measure. In other words, you know, in 2020, it's an entirely different series of comparisons because the process by which people get into the system changed so much.
In Erie County, John Flynn said he doesn't think there's less enforcement of lower-level crimes, but that the work of law enforcement has changed since COVID-19 started. There are ripple effects to everything, he said. For example, with bars closed, less people are driving home drunk.
With bars being closed, restaurants being closed, no more weddings, no more social events, that, you know, that eliminates pretty much the majority of that crime right there, all right? And again, you take other crimes, you know, assaults, robberies, burglaries, all right? You know, people can't burglarize homes because people are at home now.
All three DAs agree that COVID-19 has changed the way that they do their jobs, and that's also true for other members of law enforcement. Up in Washington County, Sheriff Jeff Murphy has gone as far as telling his deputies not to interact with the public unless they absolutely have to. That's to keep those officers safe, but it could also affect their arrest rates, he said.
You know, my instruction to our deputies was, you know, minor offenses, traffic issues, things like that. You know, I'm not concerned with numbers. I'm not concerned with, you know, arrests or tickets or anything like that. I'm concerned with keeping our employees safe.
But not all crime is down around the state. Reports of domestic violence were up 30% in April. And Hoover said in his county, drug abuse has become a major problem since the COVID-19 crisis started. That's while the total number of arrests in March and the first half of April were down 60% in Orange County.
If you can prevent things, and I take a lot of time, I try to spend a lot of my time and effort as DA, and even resources that we have focusing on prevention. And so that's what we're trying to do during this period with alcohol, substance abuse, and overdoses.
And it's not just the pursuit of crime that's changed. In Albany County, Soares said they're already trying to plan for when people have to come back into court. That's going to be tough with social distancing rules.
I think we're moving now into phase two, which means can we do a hearing digitally? And if we move in that direction, I think it bodes very well.
Each prosecutor said they've learned things along the way that they may take with them after the pandemic ends. In Erie County, John Flynn said this might start a larger conversation about how to treat defendants in the criminal justice system while preserving public safety. In his county, arrests were down 60% in March and the first half of April compared to last year.
Maybe we continue to think about ways that we can not bring people into the court system, but maybe get them into another system, whether it's mental health or alcohol counseling or drug counseling, instead of bringing them in the court system. So this now, I think, will facilitate that conversation.
We may not see the full impact of COVID-19 on the state's justice system for months. A flood of legal disputes could overwhelm the state's courts, and that would cost everyone a lot of money. Hank Greenberg from the State Bar Association has more on that and what they're doing to help. Hank Greenberg from the New York State Bar Association, great to have you here on New York Now this week. Finally, we've been trying to set it up for months, and here you are now.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for having me.
So the theme of this week's show is access to justice, and you are one of the people that I thought it was really important to talk to because you are one of the leaders in the legal industry, and you have really your finger on the pulse of what's happening in the state's courts and really how people have that access to justice. And I want to start there. What have you heard from attorneys, litigants, judges about how the courts are operating right now and how smooth of a transition it's been from our regular court proceedings to this kind of whole digital new infrastructure that we're looking at here?
Well, the state court system over the course of the last 4 weeks, 5 weeks, has done an extraordinary job moving from a physical and actual platform to a virtual platform. So now we have what the courts refer to as a virtual court system. And that's being stood up and improved with every passing day because no one would have anticipated the world we now live in. And the courts are now in a place where cases that were pending before COVID-19 struck are being addressed by judges and their staff across the state. The open question, of course, is when will we move to a place where we'll be able to allow for new lawsuits to be filed? And of course, now that the governor's reopening plan is going into motion, phase one in May 15th, I guess May phase two a few weeks thereafter, in those communities where government buildings are reopened, I would expect we'll see courthouses physically reopening. How proceedings are addressed in an open courtroom in a world with physical distancing, that's still to be determined.
Right. That's the big question going forward, both for civil proceedings and you have criminal proceedings as well, is, you know, how do you get a jury in there when you can't have people close together? Is that even possible? That kind of question. I want to focus on the civil side of things with you because we're going to be talking about criminal law at a different part of this week's show. But when you look at proceedings like this, I'm just imagining these everyday proceedings that you see in a court, like family proceedings and personal injury cases. And it must be so different. And can you help me kind of divide where things are right now? Can people file new lawsuits along those lines or start new proceedings in the face of family proceedings right now? Or are all of those closed off right now?
No, all of them are not closed off. Certain emergency court proceedings, the ones you could probably guess, are open. So those cases that sort of rise to the level of, let's just describe them as critical to the basic functioning of our justice system and our criminal justice system, the courts are hearing in real time.
So you were building this network with the state court system that I think is just this fantastic initiative where you're building this network of pro bono attorneys, which are attorneys that will represent somebody at no cost. And there are two areas that I want to focus on, but we can look a little broader as well. The first is unemployment. And we know that the state has a huge problem with unemployment right now in terms of a backlog of claims. They're going through them as fast as they can. But help me understand, if I'm a person who is filing for unemployment and I've reached a part of the process, at what part of that process would I want to reach out to an attorney? What people should be taking advantage of this kind of service that you're putting together?
Well, we are making available free legal assistance for those persons who have filed a claim for unemployment insurance benefits and the claim was denied. There's evidence that people who are represented by counsel fare much better during the appeal process than people who aren't. And by definition, someone who's filing unemployment insurance claims and seeking those benefits in all likelihood is in a position where they can't afford an attorney. So we have reached out and built a volunteer corps of lawyers all throughout the state, from Niagara Falls to Montauk. Whatever the outcome is of their appeal, simply having the opportunity to talk to a thoughtful, intelligent, empathetic person who can hear their problem, hear their legal situation, and have explained to them what their options are, we've discovered is a source of some solace and comfort to these people, and hopefully their appeal process works out as well as possible for them.
I think the same is true for tenants and the tenant-landlord disputes, which you also have these pro bono attorneys for that purpose as well. As our viewers know, the governor has an eviction waiver, so people can't be evicted for not paying rent right now. But that doesn't mean that they may not need an attorney at some point over these next couple of months. Can you kind of briefly explain why people would be seeking attorneys right now outside of eviction areas?
After COVID-19, there's going to be, we believe, just an unprecedented demand for legal services, especially impacting the poor and minorities in the state. So the landlord-tenant area, that field with so many people unable to pay rent who are unemployed, those disputes are just growing and growing and growing. If you think of a dam and the water behind the dam, rising and rising and rising in terms of disputes between landlords and tenants. When the moratorium is lifted, the opportunities for litigation, lawsuits of all kinds will be enormous. We're going to be looking to try to create alternative dispute resolution models that will allow people to try to work out their differences even before August 20. Because if those cases are not resolved and the floodwaters keep growing and growing and growing, and we don't find a way to begin to adjust those disagreements, have people reach resolutions and settlements that are workable for them, then come August 20, when the courts are open, they will be overwhelmed by these cases. So we've put together a blue ribbon group, the best and the brightest. They're looking at that issue. They're thinking of different ways from a public policy perspective so that we can address this growing demand. And also, as I said, we're standing up a statewide network of attorneys who will be trained to help people who can't afford an attorney in this area.
So just so I don't miss anything, the pro bono network that you have formed, we mentioned unemployment, we mentioned housing issues. Are there any other legal issues that these attorneys are going to be able to help people with that we should mention to our viewers?
Yes, many, and almost as many different areas as the imagination can conjure, because COVID-19 is putting on the legal system stresses and strains, creating new types of cases and disputes, all of which are now on pause, but in short order, will begin to occupy judges and courts and juries. So, for example, we imagine that when the crisis passes, we'll see an unprecedented number of disputes between creditors and debtors, family court proceedings, you name it, a wide array. So, you know, we're looking everywhere for volunteers, and we're very gratified by the response so far.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on it. Hank Greenberg from the New York State Bar Association, always great to have your perspective on this topic. Always great to give this information to our viewers. Thanks so much for being here on New York Now.
Thank you so much, Dan. Really appreciate you giving us this time.
As the state starts to reopen, there's all these questions about who would be to blame for a new outbreak of COVID-19. The state already made it harder to sue doctors and nursing homes during the pandemic, but some want those protections expanded. Tom Stebbins from the Lawsuit Reform Alliance joined me to explain. Tom Stebbins from the Lawsuit Reform Alliance, thanks so much for joining us here on New York Now this week.
Great to be with you, Dan.
So we're talking about something that I think a lot of people would not foresee coming from the COVID-19 pandemic, which is people trying to sue other people and companies because they feel like that other person or company may have done something that would merit a lawsuit, which is liability is what it comes down to. Liability meaning when somebody does something and you think they might have been negligent, so you want to sue them or a company or something like that. And I know that the state has put some protections in place right now to dismiss liability, make sure that people do not sue companies or people that may be in the healthcare industry. And I want to ask you to kind of explain that a little bit. So do we have doctors and hospitals that are exempt from liability in lawsuits right now? How far does that reach for us?
Well, one of the things that the governor did right at the outset of the pandemic was to cover doctors, medical professionals, and importantly, volunteer medical professionals from liability related to COVID. Now, you can still sue, but if it's in relation to COVID, you have to prove a particular barrier, which is gross negligence, right? So you can still sue, but you have to essentially say that they were grossly negligent. And that was so important to get many of the volunteers, of which we got tens of thousands, to come out of retirement, to come from other states, and to come to help at the outset of the pandemic. In early April, the legislature extended those protections to hospitals and medical facilities. And the entire legislature voted on that as part of the budget process. And again, it was with the caveat of gross negligence and willful misconduct. So if somebody gets COVID, it is not necessarily the doctor or hospital's fault, unless they were grossly negligent or engaged in willful misconduct.
When you say gross negligence, which is the standard you would have to meet to actually bring one of these lawsuits if you were able to, what does that rise to? I know that we can't really give specific examples because there are obviously a lot of different situations here, but would this be something where maybe a healthcare facility or a doctor blatantly ignored the state's regulations or something like that? Or does it have to go further than that? What's the kind of range that we're looking at there?
I mean, I think a good example is you have diagnosed somebody positive with COVID, and then you put them into a room with somebody without COVID, right? And somebody who is there for some other medical procedure, right? That would be grossly negligent, because simply we know, even as non-medical professionals, that that's not a good idea. So, and a doctor should know that, and I think that would rise to the level of grossly negligent. And then willful misconduct is, of course, you know, this person I don't like and I'm going to do something to make their life problematic. And that would be willful misconduct, which is one of the other standards that is the caveat to these kinds of protections.
So what about nursing homes? Because something that you said that struck me is like putting COVID patients into non-COVID places. And I know we had allegedly a problem with that in some nursing homes in New York State. Do these liability protections from the governor and the legislature extend to nursing homes? Are they exempt from being sued because of COVID-related situations?
Again, you're not exempt from being sued. You can still be sued.
Right.
You just have to prove gross negligence. And in the case of nursing homes, you bring up a great example, because Governor Cuomo decided that nursing homes need to accept COVID patients. And so just by accepting it, you are accepting a certain degree of risk, but the government has insisted that you do that. So it is not something that you could avoid. It is an unavoidable risk, and therefore liability should not be applied.
So just to clarify for my viewers, because I've said this probably incorrectly like three times during this interview, it's not that you can't sue, it's that you have a higher standard to sue is what we're
exactly
looking at. And I know that this extends far beyond healthcare facilities, including nursing homes, hospitals, things like that. But as we start to go through this reopening process, there's all of these questions of retailers and businesses and what kind of regulations are going to apply to them. And are they eligible for that higher threshold of a lawsuit, or are they in the regular realm of being sued and things like that? I know you're part of a coalition that wants stronger liability protections for these businesses. Tell me what that would look like and why you want to see it.
Yeah, so we joined with a number of other businesses, including hospitality groups, to call on the governor to extend those liability protections to retailers, to grocery stores, to pharmacies, to those kinds of groups, to say that they're not essentially liable for COVID in their stores as long as they weren't grossly negligent, and importantly, in the case of businesses and reopening, as long as they complied with state and federal guidelines and regulations. And those guidelines would include, for example, face masks. So as long as the business is compliant with that, and then a customer or employee comes down with COVID, it is not necessarily the business's fault, and you did not necessarily contract it at that business. It is impossible, essentially, to prove that would happen. And we want to protect retailers, we want to protect grocery stores and other places that are reopening from those kinds of lawsuits. Because for a lot of small businesses, win or lose, a lawsuit can be devastating. And so we want to provide those protections and help our businesses understand that they can't, that they are protected during these uncertain times.
All right, well, we will leave it there. Tom Steppens from the Lawsuit Reform Alliance, your perspective is much appreciated on the show. A lot of great explaining of how the legal system works and how this all affects everyone. Thanks so much for being here on New York Now this week.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
We have more coverage for you every day over on our website at nynow.org. And don't forget to follow us on social media at nynow_PBS. Until then, I'm Dan Clark. Thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.